Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 267th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a beloved TV actor who made his name 30 years ago as Zach Morris on the NBC sitcom Saved by the Bell, and who has appeared on many other notable series, including ABC's NYPD Blue and TNT's Franklin and Bash, en route to his current gig as the star of Fox's The Passage, a dystopian vampire thriller of a drama series for which he could conceivably land the first primetime Emmy nomination of his 35-year career. Mark Paul Gosselaar. Over the course of our conversation at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter, the 45-year-old and I discussed how he broke into show business as a toddler and wound up playing Zach Morris, initially on the Disney Channel's short-lived series Good Morning, Miss Bliss, which was then reimagined as Saved by the Bell, how he was professionally, socially, and financially impacted by his 5 years in the Saved by the Bell sphere, which included the series, spin-off series, and two TV movies, and how things changed for him when that chapter came to an end, how he then emerged from child stardom, shed his momager, and reemerged as a constantly in-demand adult actor, thanks in no small part to the late Stephen Bochco, who was behind not only NYPD Blue, but also Commander-in-Chief and Raising the Bar, two other shows on which Gosselaar appeared, and why his last two shows, Fox's Pitch and Now The Passage, are among those of which he is proudest. So, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Mark Paul, thank you so much for joining us. We have had over 250 guests on this podcast, from Meryl Streep to Steven Spielberg, but I don't know if any have had the personal significance of this one. I feel like I grew up watching you, trying to be as cool as you, following your whole career, so I really appreciate it. We always begin with just some basics. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
Born and raised in Los Angeles, in the Valley, Panorama City, which is close by Sun Valley, so Deep Valley.
Yes.
My parents are Dutch immigrants that traveled to the U.S. a few years before I was born. I am one of four. My siblings were all born in Holland, and there's a big gap between them and myself. My next sibling is 11 years older than me.
You guys, if what I read is correct, actually grew up speaking
Dutch.
Dutch in the house, yeah.
Yeah, so Dutch was probably my first language in the house, obviously. And then, I went to school, a little private school here in the Valley called Laurel Hall. And I was there for many years. And then I've been basically a LA kid my entire life.
So you started in the public eye at a very early age. I mean, people think it was an early age to see you in Saved by the Bell, but it goes way back before that.
Yeah.
How did it start? Why did it start? Was it something you were choosing to pursue, or you were encouraged to pursue, or how did it all get going?
No, I mean, my mother was not in the business. My father was absolutely not in the business. My father worked at an aluminum plant in Torrance. My mother was a housewife and raised us. She had a friend, the way I remember the story, she had a friend who was a print model. And she said, the typical, you have a really cute son. If you want to get him into print work, I can steer you into a direction of an agent. And I think that's how it started. It was one of those things where I do a print ad for May Company or Sears or something like that. And then eventually that turned into then going for commercials and then going for theatrical work.
But we're talking starting as early as four?
I think my first print ad was four, yeah.
Wow. So Were you able to simultaneously have any semblance of a normal childhood? Were you in a regular school?
No, I was in a regular school. I was in a regular school all the way up until Saved by the Bell. Saved by the Bell was, I started filming that when I was 12. I had just started high school, or I was about to start high school. Can't really remember, but that was the first time where I was working, you know, 6-7 months out of the year, and a school couldn't keep up with that, so I had to go to a special school. I couldn't go to my local high school. For me, I didn't grow up saying, I want to be an actor.
Right.
I didn't even know that was possible.
Right.
I did it because it was fun. It was sort of an after-school activity, much like Little League or Pop Warner. You would just go to interviews and possibly do 3 a day, and I would do my homework in the car. And I remember the drive. I drove it this morning coming here was over Laurel Canyon. Yeah. My school was on Oxnard and Laurel Canyon. I'd get in the car after school, do my homework, make that drive over Laurel Canyon, and then go into Hollywood, go to a few auditions, and then head back home.
And the acting itself, it doesn't sound like there was even time for you to have taken courses and stuff. So this is just a natural gift, or how would you describe it?
I don't know about natural gift. I think it's something I still work at it today. I just watched a cut of my last show, episode 10. Mm-hmm. And again, I wrote notes of things that I need to work on, things that I wanted to improve upon. And for me, acting was, I didn't go to a lot of classes, but I would just learn and be open to being taught as I worked. So on set, that's where I figured I got my education as an actor.
And you enjoyed the process of actually doing it?
Yeah, I think I did. I mean, there was sometimes I wouldn't, you know, when I'd be outside playing with my friends and then I'd get called in to go for an audition, or my mom would say I couldn't get a scratch because I just booked a commercial and I had to make sure that all my teeth were in my head.
Right place, yeah.
Yeah, so that wasn't fun because I had a relatively normal, I mean, normal in air quotes,
right.
What's normal, but right. I had a relatively normal upbringing in childhood.
Well, I think there's a common misconception that you just kind of came out of the blue with Saved by the Bell. But in fact, if you look at the filmography, the 86, 87, 88, these years right before it, can I just mention some of these major shows that you were, you know, doing an episode or two on? Twilight Zone, Wonder Years, Punky Brewster, Charles in Charge. Did you get a sense that you were building momentum towards something like Saved by the Bell, or were those what was that?
Again, there was no end game. There was no goal. There was, you know, I see these, I'm working with one who, she's super talented and she has a direction. She sees her peers and there is something to work towards. For me, I felt like, and my mom had no idea because she wasn't in the industry, but we just went wherever the current took us. I auditioned for Saved by the Bell. Well, actually Miss Bliss, and then Saved by the Bell. Before that, I had worked on a film that Alan Arkin's wife wrote. It was called Necessary Parties, and Alan Arkin starred in it as well. And he became a mentor to me. Wow. I lived in New York with him for about a month while I was filming. And I asked him when I got the script for Saved by the Bell, if this is something that I should do.
Or for Miss Bliss.
Or for Miss Bliss, yes, right. Yes. No, actually, it was actually Saved by the Bell. Miss Bliss seemed like a one-off kind of thing. It never, there was nothing behind it, but Saved by the Bell was going to be
a bigger thing.
Network NBC.
Can we just, for listeners, just to break it down quickly, that basically, and stop me if any of this is wrong, but my understanding was that NBC at the time in the late 80s is run by Brandon Tartikoff, who wants to make a show modeled after a teacher who had inspired him. And so Peter Engel comes up with Good Morning, Miss Bliss, which was centered on Haley Mills, the teacher character who we then would see again in Saved by the Bell. But this was going to be centered on her, and then there was going to be kind of a central punk student in her class, which would be also called Zach Morris. So how did you even first hear about that? It only lasted one season before Zach Morris was revived in Saved by the Bell. Was there a casting director? Who first brought it to your attention?
My agent, I guess. My agent sent me on an audition for a show that I was right for. The funny thing about that was a month before I went in for the audition, I was in Harlingen, Texas at a Marine Military Academy. And I was going through a 2-week boot camp there to see if I was eligible to go to school there in the fall. Wow. And so when I came back for the audition for Saved by the Bell, my hair was a lot shorter. I had a buzz cut in Texas. And my mom used to spray Sun in my hair, trying to keep the blonde highlights in my hair. But she sprayed Sun in, and I'm not sure if she actually dyed it, but that's how I went in as the character of Zach.
Wow.
And that's why we had to keep the kind blonde. Of the dye job going for the next 6 years.
You're actually what, like brown?
I'm naturally brown. Yeah. I think we all, at some point as little kids, had the blonde highlights, sandy blonde.
Yeah.
But my mom kept it up even more with the Sun in, which I'm sure you can't even buy anymore because it's toxic. But yeah, again, like it just shows that I wasn't aware. I didn't have a direction. I wanted to be a Marine, to be honest with you.
Wow.
My father's friend, Dave, I remember his name was a Marine helicopter pilot. And I looked up to him and that's what I thought I was going to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, Brandon Tartikoff, it was a pet project for him. Miss Bliss. I don't know if it was canceled because of ratings. I mean, at that age, I had no idea.
Disney Channel. Yeah.
So I wasn't even aware of ratings. I don't even know if
just show up
to work. Right. And then there was a reboot. I mean, that's sort of the story of Saved by the Bell, that every season we thought we were canceled. Every year, it was one of those things where you would look to Brandon and Brandon would give you the thumbs up because his daughter liked the show.
Right.
And then we do another season of Saved by the Bell.
So basically, though, just to continue with so people can follow the chronology here, you have that one season of Good Morning, Miss Bliss canceled or ended or whatever. Now they decide to do a pilot with a show centered more on not only Zach, but all the students. So once that pilot got picked up, they're going to put this on Saturday mornings. I don't think there were other shows like that on Saturday mornings.
No, there
mornings.
Wasn't.
Yeah?
No.
So it was a weird
gamble. They called it the tween audience.
Yeah.
That was a term that was brought up.
Yeah, that was the beginning of that. So once it went on the air in this unconventional time slot, I know you're saying season to season you weren't sure where it was going, but it ends up 86 episodes over 4-5 seasons, depending on how you count the college years and whatever. But what was the reception out of the gate? Were people into it?
Crickets. Yeah, pretty much. You know, social media wasn't around, so it's not, we didn't have a barometer of our success. It wasn't a show that, I mean, I was still going to regular high school.
Right.
After every season, so.
But did you get the sense when you now are not on set, when you're back among your peers and out in the world, nobody treated you differently?
Nobody. The only people that treated us differently is we were 16 and we were going to clubs.
Right. What was that about?
Well, because it's you're on TV.
Right.
And so you could find yourself back in those days, the Wild West.
Right.
You could find yourself at some of the bigger clubs.
But you're saying throughout the run?
Throughout the run. We would do these mall tours and maybe at that point you would realize how much the audience appreciated, the show. Or I attribute that to the longevity of our shows because all six of us, the cast, obviously Mr. Belding, Dennis Haskins, probably has a different story, but it really grounded us and we were all from really good families and good kids and being on a show didn't change us.
It's amazing. That speaks well to all of you.
Well, it speaks well to all of us, but also the fact that, like I said, there was no way for us to know how much impact the show had.
And I mean,
it might have changed us if we did know.
Right. And these days you would. Right? Social media,
absolutely.
Everything.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm looking at my co-star, Sanaya, who's 12.
Yeah.
She's on Twitter. She knows how much people appreciate her.
Or conversely, not necessarily applicable to her, but when people want to be mean or whatever.
That's there too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you guys filmed in front of a live studio audience each episode, which itself is unusual for that kind of a show, I would guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
That, in a way, is, I guess, closer to theater than a lot of other TV because you've got to hit your beats and everything.
Right.
How did you like
Miss
that?
Miss Bliss wasn't in front of a live audience. Saved by the Bell was,
which is now for NBC, much bigger audience with a live studio audience.
Yeah. And then my first scene for Saved by the Bell was talking to the camera.
Right. Breaking the fourth wall.
Breaking the fourth wall, which I thought was super cool. So I think the way that it worked was Miss Bliss, I was trying to put the timeline together, but Miss Bliss was shot. Then I did the movie with Alan Arkin.
Right.
And then Saved by the Bell, because I remember when I got the script for Saved by the Bell, it was pretty much about this character, Zach Morris.
Yeah.
And I asked Alan Arkin for his advice, and he says, don't do it.
What was his reason?
He didn't give me a reason.
Yeah.
Looking back, I wonder if he maybe thought that I might have had a career in film a little bit more and tying myself to a sitcom, being known as one character.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can think of, but I do remember him saying, don't do it. And I remember what my thought was, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
It was a character. When I read the first script, I thought, this is Ferris Bueller.
Yeah.
I love that movie. I loved what Matthew Broderick did. I said, I'm going to play Ferris Bueller. This is awesome.
Just so a
I
created, smart ass.
Yeah, I'm going to play a smart ass. I mean, he's talking to the camera.
Right.
Exactly what Ferris did. And so, yeah, there was a, I remember the first night of filming in front of that audience and having to look at the camera and block out everything and just, yeah, it was pretty nervous.
Well, I want to ask you about that because, you know, the thing is,
I need to watch that scene again to see the reaction on my face because I'm really not that good at dealing with nerves. I mean, I can usually tell when I'm nervous on
the
screen.
Well, you're anticipating exactly where I want to go here because the thing with, at least as a viewer watching Zach Morris as a kid, was like, you seem like a pretty confident, or he seemed like a pretty confident
total
guy.
Character. I mean, that was the Zach Morris was a character that I created from seeing the really cool kids in my school. I was not one of those kids.
That's what I wondered.
I was a kid that I wasn't in the low end and I wasn't in the top. I was somewhere in the middle.
Right.
And I would just observe and I would see, you know, both sides of things. But Zach was a character that I was good at playing because I could manipulate my eyebrow to kind of give me a, you know, lack of a better word, of a smirky, douchey look. And the hair, you know, I did the hair enough, you know.
And I think the uneven smile, right? The
uneven smile, a little smirk. I mean, I had all these little things that I could do to make me be that character, but that was not me. I mean, so, if my friends would tell you that I definitely was not that character.
But over the course of the 5 years, did that character rub off on you in the sense that...
Not really, because you can see from season to season, Zach Morris changes. Right. One season, I'm like Vanilla Ice. I mean, I have my hair is shaved on the sides because I was a fan of Vanilla Ice. The next season, it's like I got this big coiffy thing going on. I don't know what... You know, I was always trying to find myself, and because those are such impressionable years
in your
life.
And you just have no real concept of the fact that out in the world, you're... age contemporaries were looking at you as, this is the way to dress, this is the hairstyle to have, that's how you get the prettiest girl. You had no idea.
No idea.
Wow.
No idea.
So while the show was happening, I guess it would be like 9 months of the year each season, and then the rest of the time you can either, I don't know,
go
back to school, right? Mm-hmm. So while it's happening, though, over those years, what's the mood? Are you guys happy to be there with each other? Were you guys, in terms of the core six, actually... friends or more than friends? Like, what was the, if you could take us back to 1991 or whatever it would be, any of those, you know, as this show is working, but for you guys being there, what was it like?
I think all of those, yeah, you could check every single one of those examples. Sometimes we loved each other and sometimes we hated each other. There were moments when Peter Engel had to sit us down and say, guys, we have to film a show here. Because sometimes we weren't talking to each other.
Because of romantic entanglements.
Yeah, entanglements. and maybe you would piss off Tiffany.
Right.
And because Tiffany's friends with Mario, now Mario's not talking to me.
Right.
And then vice versa, if something happened between Mario and I'm not talking to Mario. It was a very small universe that we lived in and we operated in. And sadly, the only one that was never really, it was always an outsider because he was 3 years younger than us, was Dustin Diamond.
Who actually, if I have correct information, so you're the first one cast, obviously, because you're coming over from Good Morning, Miss Bliss. And then
Dustin was, if you're talking about Saved by the Bell, Dustin was also in Miss Bliss.
Oh, he was. Yeah. Okay, so then it was for Miss Bliss, though, you were the first one on board, because what I read is that they would then have you read, all the other people that were potential candidates to be on the show were reading with you, and you kind of went to bat for Dustin.
Well, I don't remember reading with Dustin. It may have happened, mm-hmm. but I remember, because obviously I was 12 years old, so my memory is a little, I can't even remember what I did last week.
Right.
But I remember sitting in the waiting room to go in to read, and I remember seeing Dustin, and I remember, go back a little bit further, I remember reading the script of Miss Bliss and going, how are they going to find this character?
Right.
This is a broad character. Even at a young age, I'm thinking, they're going to have a hard time casting this character. And I walk in, I see Dustin, and I start talking with him like, he's the character.
He's the geek.
He's the guy. He's definitely going to get this job. And I may have gone in and talked with, that might be a story that Peter Engel brought up, but I may have gone in and while I was reading for my audition said that there's a great guy out there that's going to play Screech.
Get that guy.
I don't know. I mean, that could have happened. I may have said that just to loosen up the room.
So over those years between the two shows, was one of the other guys a closest friend? Was one of the girls someone that you actually... were most involved with over that time? Like, how do you...
We all traded spaces at some point or another. I mean, if you're together with the same cast for 4 years, right, at those ages, you're just cycling around from friend to friend. I mean, it was all innocent. Again, we're from the ages of 13 to, I mean, when we ended the primetime show, I was 19. Yeah. And at some point, you know, it's like everything just cycles around. But there was nothing salacious. There was nothing...
No.
You know,
well, even watching the college years, which was, I guess, the fifth season and the only season that was in prime time, I think the final episode when Zach and Kelly are trying to get married ends with a hug. So, I mean, that just kind of puts, like, today, God knows what they would have kids doing on a show like that, because kids in the real world, I think, are a little more edgy, and I don't think it's a good thing necessarily, but anyway, it's just that it was a time capsule in a way.
And really, that was us.
Yeah.
I mean, looking back at some of the storylines as an actor, you have to find things that you can relate in.
Right.
I'm not so sure I could relate to any of those storylines that we did on Saved by the Bell or the college years, but for some reason then, we kind of did because we were just good kids.
Right.
I mean, we really were.
Last two things about that chapter, if I can. I was amazed to see you say something, because here's my thing as a viewer, I think most people would relate to this. I don't feel like Saved by the Bell's ever been off the air, because it's with syndication or reruns or whatever.
It was off the air in 94 when we wrapped up the college years, until Reicher Entertainment picked up the rights to syndicate it.
Got it.
In 96. 96 is when we were syndicated, and then it took off again.
Well, so the reason I bring this up is that I would assume that, you know, when you hear about, like, Friends is now on Netflix and everybody's collecting $20 million a year and all this stuff. And then I read something you said where the only time you guys ever really were kind of compensated in a notable way was for the college years.
Yeah.
And not particularly with residuals and things that you would assume.
Not really.
How is that possible?
I don't know. You'd have to talk to our agents. I think because our agents were primarily agents for children.
Right. That hadn't had something like this.
I guess not. Yeah. I mean, because our deals, even our merchandise deals, are laughable. It's a shame. It really is. I don't think any of us are, you know, losing sleep over it.
That's great.
It's one of those things that you'd like to be compensated.
Of course.
In the fashion that some of these other shows have been. Some people made some really poor decisions on our behalf.
So eventually, when the final variation of Saved by the Bell, because again, there's the college years add-on, there was a, what would you call it, a one-off special. Like, there are all these different...
Oh, like the two-hour movies?
Yeah,
the one in Hawaii, the one in Palm Springs.
Right. So all of that, when it finally, I guess the final thing was the college years, right? That ends. What was your mindset? Were you wanting to go right into other work? Was there interest in you for other work? What was the landscape at the time for Mark Paul?
To take you back a little bit, after the original Saved by the Bell ended, and we knew that was it. We were done.
Yeah.
I wanted to play football, and so I was going to go to a local community college and try to redshirt.
Because you're 19 at this point?
I was 18. 18 at that point. I hadn't made a decision to become an actor. And then when we were approached to do the college years, I had to lose a lot of weight because I was ready to play football, which is why I was substantially bigger in the college years than I was from the last season of Saved by the Bell. And then at that point, I sort of made a decision that, wow, and we were making primetime money now. So from Saturday morning money to primetime money, there's a big jump.
It'll keep you in the game.
It'll keep you in the game. At that point, I thought, I could either have bad knees or I could make some money doing something that I actually love doing and felt I was decent at it. So after the college years, decided to become an actor. And then it was dry for a good 2 years after that.
Why do you think?
I was a character. I'd walk into a room and the first thing people would say is like, oh, you dyed your hair brown. I'm like, nope. Actually, I just cut off the blonde locks. And now more like me.
Did you feel that it was...
I was typecast. I mean, there's no way around that.
Obviously, being typecast itself is limiting, but as that character specifically, because they see him as a certain kind of guy or what?
Possibly, but the landscape was different then. You see a lot of child actors now from Disney, Nickelodeon, that will transition into a film career. Back then, you were either a TV actor or a film actor. There really was no crossover. And especially if you were a child actor, there really was no opportunity to say like, oh, you've got these great numbers, kids will follow you.
Yeah.
We're going to put you in a film because that'll generate numbers for us. We didn't have that opportunity. It happened a little bit later. And so we finished the college years in 1984. And I think my first, I mean, I want to say my real job, because I had done a few, you know, straight to DVD sort of things in Toronto that I never told my friends I was filming. But I think my first real job was in 1996 when I did some TV movies for NBC.
Right. And
that was really the start of my career again, jump start of my career.
In that dry period, how bleak was your outlook? Was there a point where you're saying, you know, maybe I should just give this up entirely and do something else? Or
yeah, every once in a while I would get those little nuggets of, you know, the movie in Toronto or some guest starring role, and they would just sort of stoke that fire again for me to say, this is what I want to do. I see a future in this. But I've had that thought as recently as 2 years ago.
After Pitch or something?
Before Pitch.
Yeah.
Actually, before Pitch, I just thought, I got to do something else. I got to get out of this business.
What would you do?
Good question. I contacted David Feige, who was the creator of Raising the Bar with Stephen Bochco, and he wrote a book called Indefensible. He's a public defender for many years and taught at Seton Hall. And I called him and I said, do you think I can pass the bar? And would you help me? And he said, yeah, pull the trigger and I'll walk you through the path.
Wow.
And I just thought, you know, I was meeting with somebody who, I went on a boys trip and we went salmon fishing up in Oregon, and there was a family law attorney up there who was a stage actor. Mm-hmm. And he said he got tired of the business and then just went into law in his 40s. And he's a very successful family attorney. I thought, well, there's hope.
Yeah, it doesn't sound that bad.
You've played
a few lawyers.
Yeah, exactly. It's, how hard could it be?
Well, one thing that you said a moment ago that I thought was really interesting is that you made the decision to be an actor after the Saved by the Bell chapter, meaning that prior to that, it wasn't entirely your decision. And at least that's what I extrapolate from that. And so what I want to ask you is, things in this business, it's like a tale as old as time, going back to Shirley Temple, I think, get tricky when family and business mix. It's just the nature of the game. And my understanding from something, I don't know if you've talked about it that much, and I don't want to ask you to talk about things that you don't want to, but the one thing I wanted to follow up on was researching here. You told People magazine in 1996, quote, "Parents get just as greedy as anybody else. We came from a very poor family, and then after making money, we got a little sidetracked," close quote. And it seemed like you had been represented essentially in the business by your mom, and I don't know, maybe your dad as well. And then as an adult, you're able to be on your own. When did you become your own person, making your own decisions in this business?
I think out of that quote you said, there's only one piece in there that isn't correct, and that was the fact that we were a poor family.
Okay.
Looking back at it, I go, we were middle class. We were pretty good. You know. But growing up, it felt... So in 96, I might have said that, but the rest of it is pretty true.
Mm-hmm.
I was represented by my mother as my manager until I was 19. And there came a point where I was surrounded by other actors, my peers, that had managers and agents, and it was a different level than what I had been brought up on. It was a very uncomfortable conversation that I had with my mother at that time, but I said to her, you're my manager, I'm paying you 10%, but you're not doing what my peers' managers are doing. You're not setting up meetings with studios and meeting with, you know, writers and things like that, and my agent wasn't really doing that either. And that's where at 19 years old, I sort of made a decision to find better representation and cut that cord, which was a super difficult conversation. Who wants that in the family? But, you know, it was rocky for a little bit, but then she understood. There's a fine line between being a manager and being a parent, because you're driving your kids to set, you're taking them to auditions, but I don't know if that necessarily categorizes as a manager, but back in those days, that's what they needed to get paid.
We hear about it. I mean, Macaulay Culkin and all these.
Sort of grew up in that same time, that same era where the parents were managers. And I keep going back because I'm working with a 12-year-old now.
Right.
Currently, her parents are her parents.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a manager and she has an agent. It's great.
Because that way the parent can full-time focus on nurturing.
That's the way it should be. But also, I don't think a parent should be compensated for just being a parent.
Right.
I mean, if you don't want to drive your kids, hire somebody to drive your kids. Don't have a kid. You know, there's other ways now.
Of course.
I don't think you need 10% to sit on set.
No.
to basically chaperone your son or daughter,
right.
That doesn't warrant a 10% commission.
No. Well, so as you, I think that's
that's a conversation I had to have at the age of 19. I look back and I don't think it was because my mother maliciously or directly was trying to, you know, commission her son.
Yeah.
It's just, that's the way things were done. It's not any different than the rest of the cast or the other, you know, kids, my peers at that time.
If it's not too personal to ask, were you guys able to get beyond that and be cool?
Yeah.
So now, as an adult in this business, it's a whole different ballgame, as you've alluded to. And you said, I think around 96, things started going again with the adult career, mm-hmm. started going for the first time as an adult career.
Well, a young adult. I mean,
young
I was still
adult,
playing
right.
at that time. It was 96. I had gotten married in 96. I was 22 years old.
Right.
And married for the first time at 96. And my first role back was with Candace Cameron Bure.
Right.
And I played a college student that was a rapist. Big stretch. I went from playing Zach Morris to all of a sudden a rapist. Yeah.
Well, it seems though like maybe the most important turning point in the career as an adult would have been when you wound up on NYPD Blue in 2001, joining in the ninth season as John Clark Jr., the son of Sipowicz's old nemesis, now his new partner. And it must have felt like a huge deal to have a major part on a major, really groundbreaking show. And I guess the key here, and for years thereafter, would have been Stephen Bochco, who co-created that show, produced it, and became a big believer in and champion of yours.
Mm-hmm.
How did you two first meet, and why do you think he took such a liking to you?
I can answer the last part rather quickly. I don't know why he took a liking to me. I went in and auditioned for Philly, which was Kim Delaney's show that he created for her after she was done with NYPD Blue. So I went in for a role, and I remember I got a call as I was going in saying they've just offered it to Tom Everett Scott. Tom Everett Scott got the role. Do you still want to go in? And I was like, oh, man. I'd worked with Tom.
Right.
We had done Dead Man on Campus, I believe, in 98.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, we're not alike. We're totally not alike. I'm going to go in anyway because I'm going to do something different than what they can offer Tom. And they gave him a straight up offer. And I thought, and for me too, I was thinking, why would they give Tom an offer?
Right.
Why didn't they give me an offer?
Right.
But he had just come off of Dead Man on Campus and That Thing You Do. So he had a lot of heat behind him. Mm-hmm. But I went in anyway. I thought, you know, I'm here. I've worked on the material. I'm just going to go in. And I did my thing. And I really didn't know who Stephen Bochco was. I wasn't a viewer of NYPD Blue. And I remember this silver-haired guy sitting there with jeans and a sweater and tennis shoes, stands up after I'm done and extends his hand. And he goes, "You're really good." And I thought, oh, thank you. You know, that's my send-off. And he goes, "No, I'd really like to work with you in the future." And I thought, okay, you know, he's just sweet talking me, but I didn't get this role.
Right.
Got it.
Right.
I know that Tom has it. And he said something that was interesting before I left. He goes, "I know it's pilot season. Let me know if you get anything." And so I made that call again to my manager directly after the meeting with Steven. And I gave him, you know, the info. And we were trying feverishly to get on any sort of pilot at that
right.
season, because we thought that Steven might have something for me.
Right. If you're saying to try to get on a pilot that he was associated
with? No, just any pilot to sort of use it as a chip to say to Steven, like, hey, Mark Paul's going
right.
to be on,
so you know, get him off that.
Get him on something else.
Because
he didn't really say what he had in mind, but we all know that working for Steven is gold.
Yeah.
I mean, if you get into that camp,
right.
I remember I was auditioning for Smallville. I was like anything and everything I was trying to get on for another pilot. And he called 2 weeks later, unsolicited, and offered me a role on NYPD Blue.
Which probably would have been more exciting than anything. What did you originally go in for again with him?
Philly.
No disrespect to Philly, but I would think NYPD Blue is probably a cooler
thing. But here's the thing. He didn't say what I was playing on NYPD Blue.
Oh.
He just called and said, how would Mark Paul like to be on NYPD Blue? And of course, we all said, duh, you know, sign us up.
And you didn't
Not
realize.
Knowing what the character was. So I'm thinking, what did he see in the room that I could play?
Right.
I guess I'm just going to play a beat cop or something, maybe, you know, sort of guest star in a few things here and there. And then he let some time go by and then said, I'm going to make him Sipowicz's partner. Rick Schroeder is leaving. So it happened first where he gave me the role, and then Rick leaves, and then he bumps me to playing. Now, he may have thought that he was going to do that all along, but he didn't.
That worked out pretty well.
He wasn't up front with it with us in the beginning. And so me thinking, oh my God, I've just been offered a role as a New York detective,
right.
LA kid.
Right.
How's this going to work?
Right.
What did he see in the room that I did that now I'm going to play Sipowicz's partner? It made no sense to me.
So what did you do to get ready?
I worked with Bill Clark, who was a technical advisor the first season of NYPD Blue, and then slowly worked his way up to executive producer and created a lot of the story content for NYPD Blue. 25 years as a detective, we used a lot of his stories. Milch and Bill Clark were hand in hand. And worked with Bill for about a month in New York and just...
Right in the deep end.
Yeah, right into the deep end.
So that was, I think, for the final four seasons of NYPD Blue, yeah. 76 episodes.
We only thought it was going to go 1 year.
Really?
Because I had come on after the ninth season, and everyone thought that...
It's winding down.
It's winding down.
Yeah.
And then we got four seasons out of it.
Wow. Amazing. And in fact, the way it ended, I believe you spoke the show's final lines.
Yeah, somebody said that the other day. I don't remember that.
But I do, regardless of whether there were final lines, your final moments in the show... I guess we're pretty emotional for probably a variety of reasons for you, right? You remember filming your final scene? Apparently, I just read one other thing where you talked about, you know, so your character refers to Sipowicz, who has now been promoted as boss.
Lieutenant, right.
But in terms of even just executing the scene, I guess it was emotional. A, it's a family that's ending, you know, but also, again, it's one of these moments like, where do you go after being a part of that caliber of a show? And are you thinking to yourself, where do I go next?
I actually thought that it was going to be a lot simpler now and easier because I had put my time, you know, in 4 years, and I thought, oh, this is going to be a breeze.
Right.
It wasn't again.
Right.
It was like Saved by the Bell all over again, where you do 4 or 5 years on a successful show, and then there's some dry moments.
It seems like Bochco himself, if I have the chronology right, may have swooped in again because you did the same year that the final episodes of NYPD Blue aired. You were in 10 episodes of Commander in Chief.
Right.
Which is Bochco.
Right, he did swoop in that because that was Rod Laurie's show. And then there was a issue with him and ABC, and then Bochco comes on.
What was it? Was Rod clash with ABC?
I guess. That was the rumors, is that, you know, Rod has a different way of doing things as Stephen Bochco.
Oh, right. It was Rod and Bochco clashing.
No. It was Rod. Right, it was Rod's show. It was created by Rod and cast by him and everything. But he may be a little slower to get to scripts as, you know, Stephen Bochco's a machine.
It was,
and TV's, it's a different landscape. I'm not saying like Rod, but it was a very difficult show.
Yeah.
It was very well executed. I was a fan of that show before I came on board because Rod actually, we had met at a restaurant one time and he gave me a really nice compliment. So after that, I was like a huge fan of his. So when Commander in Chief came out, I thought, I'm going to watch his show. And
we should remind people, this is a female president. Long before that seemed like a realistic possibility.
Gina Davis.
And
Donald Sutherland.
Well, that's who I want to come to next.
Some more people that I got to learn from. And we'll
talk about, because there was one story regarding Donald Sutherland on that show that, I mean, again, we're talking only 10 episodes, but he made an impression on you.
No, 10 episodes for me.
Right, that's what I mean,
right,
for
right.
you.
Yeah, yeah.
But like in that relatively short time on the show for you, you had at least one experience with Sutherland that I think made a big impression, right?
He's an imposing figure.
Right.
I mean, he's 6'4", something like that. And he would wear this big parka on set, which made him look even bigger.
Right.
It'd be 100 degrees outside. He'd still wear these parkas. And he had his own little trailer land. And he had these two Jack Russell Terriers that would sort of guard it. And he had this assistant guy. He was just a character. I love characters. But he could rub people the wrong way. You were not allowed to smoke anywhere near his set. If he was on set and you smelled like smoke, he'd ask you to leave.
Wow.
And I loved it. I loved the guy. I mean, I thought, here's a legend that I get to work with. And so I had a great relationship with him. He knew that I rode motorcycles and we talked motorcycles and things like that. And
was there something about an eyeline shot?
No, it was, I remember we were filming in Hancock Park and we can't bring trailers into Hancock Park. So you park a mile away and you shuttle in to the set. And we filmed a scene where he's speaking with Natasha Henstridge at the time, who was my love interest on the show. So he's having a conversation with her. I'm in the background, and eventually you'll cut to my scene where I sort of notice them. So we shoot Donald's scene first with Natasha, and then he heads off, and now we're repositioning, and we're going to shoot my scene. Then they said, well, before we start filming, hold on, we're waiting for Donald to come back. And I said, no, 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 Donald doesn't have to come back. He's going to be my eyeliner. I just put up a C-stand with a with a piece of tape. It's fine. Leave him in his trailer because, you know, I don't want him to take that drive and you know, just preserve Donald.
Right.
They said, nope, he's coming in. Oh, man. So I thought he's going to think that I want him here or that I demanded him to be here. So he comes on set and I said, Mr. Sutherland. I always used to call him Sir Donald or Mr. Sutherland. Right.
Intimidating.
He's intimidating, but I have such a soft spot in my heart for him. And I said, Mr. Sutherland, I'm so sorry. I did not request that you are here for my eye line. I could have easily used a C-stand. He goes, son, I'm an actor. This is what I do. And he stood over there and he acted his whole side of that scene while I used him as an eyeline. And wow. I thought, my God, you know, here's a man who's in his 70s at the time who has that fire and that drive that, you know, you wish everybody that you worked with had.
So that's why he got his honorary Oscar a year ago or whatever, a year ago. That's
He's a fantastic actor. Dennis was the same way.
Dennis Haskins
Franz. Dennis Franz. Dennis Haskins I just was too young to know what he was doing. Somebody had said, you're now Dennis's age when you were filming. I'm now Dennis's age when we were filming Saved by the Bell.
You are now, just so people know, this is Mr. Belding.
Mr. Belding. I'm now his age when we were filming Saved by the Bell.
I think you've got a little more hair still, though.
A little bit more hair. So, but yeah, I learned from these actors and... You learn what to do and what not to do.
Yeah.
Still goes on to this day.
After that, I guess the next, you know, one that's important to talk about would be Raising the Bar, which ran for 25 episodes, 2008 to 2009, show about the lives of young public defenders and junior prosecutors coexisting in and out of the courtroom. You're playing a defense attorney, this guy Jerry, another Bochco-produced project, 2 seasons. I guess generally anything about that show, but also does it hurt or do you get used to when a show that you're passionate about, and I know we'll come to this more with Pitch, but like with this case, do you just at a certain point, does it, you know, just run right off of you or does it hurt when, you know, you're liking it and you feel it's working, but somebody else doesn't?
No, it still hurts. It still stings. Raising the Bar just started off slow. It really did. I thought that, given the fact that it was on TNT and given the fact that Bochco wrote it and the built-in audience that travels with him and the caliber of the writing and the directing and all of that, you think that's a winning formula. And then when it doesn't work out, you're thinking to yourself, well, God, what do I need to do to sustain something on the air? No, it doesn't hurt any more or less. It's part of the process, but that was the start of my relationship with TNT, and then from there was offered to do Franklin and Bash.
Yeah, it's like 2 years later, kind of came right out of it.
Raising the Bar, I went to go do theater in New York.
Yeah.
End of 2009 into 2010, shot the pilot for Franklin and Bash, March of 2010.
Wow.
And then we started filming in September of 2010, and did 4 years of that.
Before we talk about Franklin and Bash, though, that. For you to go and do in 2009 what you're talking about, to go to New York where you hadn't spent much time.
No time.
No time prior to
that. I went in to audition for that role. Bradley Cooper had done it in the summer theater. I'm not a theater guy. What is that called when they go?
Like summer stock or whatever.
Summer stock up in New York.
Oh, yeah.
So Bradley Cooper had done that role with Julie White.
Right.
And I believe Justin Kirk, maybe, at summer stock.
And this role is, it's in a Teresa Rebeck show. I knew about her because
fantastic,
terrific writer, and called The Understudy. You're playing an action movie star making his Broadway debut in a Lost Kafka play, which itself sounds crazy.
Yeah, and it was nuts.
But I have a lot of respect for the fact, first of all, I have a lot of respect for anyone that does theater where you're doing, probably in this case as well, eight times a week, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't make the kind of money that TV or film people do. They're not famous as generally in the same degree. And they're killing themselves, but often I think they're the most talented people there are.
Very talented.
You know, so for you, why did, you know, you're at that point a very well-known person. In 2009, you're what, in your 30s?
I was 35.
What made you give it a try?
I had an agent at the time that was thinking outside the box.
Yeah.
She was Chris Schmidt over at Paradigm. She was into theater and said, you should give it a shot.
Yeah.
You're young and I think you'd be really good at it. I think you'd really enjoy it. And she was right.
Yeah, you got great notices.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah. I went in, I met with the director, Scott Ellis, here in Los Angeles, and I basically said to him, this is pretty much the first play I've read in years, and I've never been on stage, and I have no idea what I'm doing. That was basically the character.
Yeah,
it was this action guy who decides to do theater for the first time. And it's a three-person play, Julie White, Justin Kirk, and myself, for 90 minutes.
And an awesome, intermission, right?
You no just, intermission, just an awesome, that experience alone, I wish I could do that more.
What did you like about it?
The control as an actor, because once you're up on stage, it's just you and the other actors. You can do anything.
Right. Because TV and film, it's not your, it's not the my, writer, it's the director.
It's the writers, yeah. it's less so the writers, but it's the director, the editors, the producers, right. It's their product. And once we got on stage, it's the actors.
And, you know, a lot of people, I used to feel this way before I got into theater. I know a lot of people still do. They say, you know, I don't know how long you did the understudy, but let's say it was...
From August until January.
Right. So, okay. So 5 months or whatever. Sure. People say, how can you do the same thing 8 times a week for 5 months? And aren't you going to get bored and it's repetitive? Yeah. Tell why that's not true.
No, it's really not true. We did over 70 shows and each one is different. Every single moment was its own moment. From the first shows until the last shows, it would feel like a completely different vehicle. You just make changes from show to show, from moment to moment. It was just, honestly, it was just the whole process really was uncomfortable for me. I'm not a big rehearser. I don't like to rehearse. And so...
You'd never had to.
I never had to. I mean, we rehearse, you know, when you're on set, when you're doing these shows, you're basically rehearsing to see if everyone has the lines. And then where you're going to be standing, and we'll move the cameras in. Rehearsal process could take maybe 10 minutes, maybe at the most, every scene. With rehearsal for theater, it was a month worth of rehearsals. And
you're away from your family.
You're away from your family, and for me, it was really uncomfortable because I don't know the character yet, and I'm allowing someone to see me develop a character, and I wasn't used to that. Usually when you come on set, I'm already in character. I am the character. And in theater with Scott Ellis, he wanted to shape the character. And having to do that with other people observing, Julie White and Justin, I was incredibly uncomfortable with the process. After that, I just fell in love with it.
Yeah.
And wanted to do more. Unfortunately, it doesn't pay. Right. You're away from your family. There's not a lot of...
It's a lot of time, a lot of work.
Yeah, it's a lot of time, a lot of work. I don't have the luxury anymore to do that at this point in my career. I'd love to go back.
At some point,
I absolutely will go back.
And you came away from that, you think, a better actor when you were now going into Franklin and Bash, again, lawyers, two ambulance chasers.
A theater actor Franklin and Bash.
Even just from the experience, though, I mean, I would imagine that there are things that it just sharpens you, probably.
It sharpens you. I mean, I don't know that I needed a lot of training for Franklin and Bash, other than just being open and aware and feeding off of my co-star, Brecken. I mean, we just...
Franklin to your Bash.
Yeah, the Franklin and Bash. We still don't know who's Franklin and who's Bash. But he and I just worked really well off each other. We were just... It felt like the 4 years of filming Franklin and Bash was a riff.
Yeah.
It wasn't. There was a blueprint there that we adhered to. But for the most part, we really enjoyed feeding off of each other and made some really fun stuff happen on screen.
I came across a thing that, if it's true, it's pretty crazy. When did you two first meet?
We met like briefly in an airport one time. I forget where we were traveling to, and we bonded over Xbox. And I remember us just going, "Hey, love your work, love your work."
Now, he says, in
a hotel, in an airport bathroom.
No,
that's what he would say. Right,
no. He says that, and I don't have any reason to believe that he's joking or anything. And maybe there's no reason for you to have remembered this, but he says, quote, "I grew up at the same time that you were.
Yeah, yeah.
He says, "I was acting like I used their sets one time, Saved by the Bell sets, when I did a pilot, and I met Mark Paul as a kid."
He may have.
But, you know, I'm sure it meant more to him than you at that time.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't.
But that's kind of interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, he may have, well, I think they may have used our sets. I don't know whether or not he would have seen me, though, because if you're using my sets, we're
I
backed.
Know, you wouldn't be there, but yeah. Anyway, he claims he met you. But yeah. It's nice that, you know, you guys had great chemistry. The show goes 4 seasons. Then comes the one that it feels like to me, from everything you've ever spoken about it, was maybe as important to you and that you're as proud of as any
part. Before Pitch, if that's what
you're going. That's where I'm going. So what was between
the NBC pilot or show? It was a sitcom. A hybrid that Pam Fryman directed, DJ Nash created.
Okay.
It was called Truth Be Told. And that was on NBC, and we ran 10 episodes. And I thought, here's what my thinking was. After Franklin and Bash, only doing 10 episodes a year for 4 years and wanting to do more. And 10 is really, I mean, it's not a great living. It's a living.
Because they pay by the episode or what?
They pay by the episode. You're maybe working 4 months a year.
Right.
You're now tied to the show for the remainder of the year. There's not much you can do. You could possibly do like a 3-episode arc on something. You can do a film.
Because how many episodes were you doing with Saved by the Bell?
I mean, good luck doing a film, though, you know, being on cable. And they're not making those types of films anymore. It's either big films or big actors are doing small films.
But like when you were on NBC doing Saved by the Bell, what was it, like 30-something episodes?
No, we did 22 a year.
22, okay.
22 or 21.
So now it's just a Jeff, a point of reference. So this, so now you're
we're doing 10 episodes. I had done 10 episodes of television since Raising the Bar. I think Raising the Bar, we did 10 the first, 15 the second.
Yeah.
Before that was Commander in Chief. I only did 10 episodes.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I've only been doing 10 episodes of television for
years. Yeah, well,
it's not, you know, financially, it's not a great model to follow.
You have four kids.
I have four kids. So it's not a great model to follow. So my thinking after Franklin and Bash of doing 10 episodes for the last 6 years.
Right.
Possibly longer, is I'm going to get on a sitcom, and I want that 22. I'm going to go, you know, on a
Big Bang Theory.
Big Bang Theory, man. Big Bang, How I Met Your Mother.
Right.
I'm thinking, this is the life.
Right.
I am going to retire.
Right.
I've been in this business way too long. So I get a sitcom on the air, and we do 10.
Right.
It gets canceled. God. Then after that, I audition for Pitch.
So Pitch is co-created by Dan Fogelman and debuted at almost the exact same time as another little show he created, called This Is Us.
Well, the story is that he created both for 20th, and Fox passed on This Is Us, not thinking that it was part of their model. So they picked up Pitch, and This Is Us went to NBC.
That's pretty bad.
Well, I mean, it's still owned by 20th.
Right.
You know, so it's
they'll
not that
okay,
big. They'll be okay, but it's not on Fox. And who knows? Maybe not. It might not have worked
for
well.
Each network has their
has their brand, and This Is Us fits on that brand.
So Pitch, you're playing Mike Lawson, professional baseball catcher at the end of his career, catching a female pitcher, at this point. And
sort of tell you the story about the audition, sorry to cut you off, is that Kevin Falls is the co-executive producer along with Dan Fogelman. Kevin Falls was the executive producer for and creator of Franklin and Bash. And so I read this script and I thought I could play this character. Plus I have an in. I'm gonna call Kevin.
Right.
I know he's working on this. So I call Kevin, I say, what are my chances? What can you do for me? He's like, I ain't going to do anything for you. He's like, you're going to come in here and read for Dan. Dan wants everybody to read. I go, okay.
Yep.
You know, it's like actors generally don't like to read. But for that, I was willing to read because it wasn't a character that you have seen me play before. And then I went in and read.
Why is it that that character ended up meaning so much to you? You really made it your own. And then again, what's it like when probably more so than ever you're invested in something that then gets the rug pulled out from under it?
It's not necessarily that character. It's who I was working with and the environment that I was allowed to work in. It's similar in a way to NYPD Blue, that particular environment. It's a safe environment. It's a creative environment. You're working with people that you really want to work with. Franklin and Bash, same thing. Working alongside people that I every day, you know, you're working with them for 16 hours a day. I loved being in the same room with these people creatively, personally, and same with Pitch. Pitch, I'm working again with Kevin Falls. Dan is an amazing human being and writer. The material that we were getting every single episode was some of the best I'd been given. The actors, Kylie Bunbury, Mark Consuelos, Mo McRae, Ali Larder. I mean, these were just really good people to be in the room with. Pitch was tough because, and I told Dan, I said, you really fucked it up for me, because arguably some of the best material. And when you saw the finished product, I was so proud of the finished product. I thought that that was the winning formula. I thought that that was it. I'm going to be on this show until I retire. Mm-hmm. And then for it to not go,
It was one.
I said the reason why you fucked me up is because you had all the elements there, and if that didn't go,
right,
what are my chances for getting something else to go?
Why do you think it didn't go?
I feel that it was at the wrong time. I don't know if it was a wrong place, but it was a wrong time. It just was in a political environment at that time. Hillary Clinton was up against Donald Trump,
right,
and people thought it was politically motivated, that it was a vehicle for Hillary in some way.
Could it be reincarnated?
Sure.
You'd be down?
I think all of us would be in. Yeah. I know that I would be. We talk about it all the time. Kylie, myself, Kevin,
yeah.
I've talked with Dan.
Yeah.
We'd all step up to the plate.
Yes. Good metaphor for that. All right. This brings us to the main course, because I think, was that the beginning of your relationship with Fox, right?
Yes.
And is that purely coincidental, or did that have a direct lead into The Passage?
I had a direct lead in.
How did that work?
So Pitch was 20th Century Studio,
yep,
on Fox. At the time that I was filming Pitch, I had sold a show with Breckenmeyer.
Oh yeah, you guys started.
I had an idea, and I wanted Brecken to write it, yeah, and we ended up selling it to ABC, ABC Studios and ABC, and then 20th gave me a development deal out of that, and so I had a really good relationship with 20th. And then while we were waiting for the outcome of Pitch, The Passage was sort of laying around. I knew about it because I was asking 20th some of their projects that they're currently working on. What direction can I go in terms of things that I'm creating? And so I read The Passage and saw that I potentially could be that character.
And we should just say for listeners, if they haven't yet discovered it, Brad Wolgast is a distinguished military vet who is now working for the government to deliver to people who he doesn't really necessarily at first know what they're doing, but deliver people to them. Is that, without spoiling it, is that a fair way to...
You're not really spoiling anything.
I've seen it.
It's so crazy because the show, like, how do you condense the show? It's based on a trilogy of books written by Justin Cronin. My character is just a small piece of this epic puzzle.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you basically said what the beginning stages, the early stages of my character are, and then he's gonna
People he's got to deliver he's expected to deliver is a child.
Yeah.
And there he has, because of his own personal recent past with his own child, has some moral
dilemma and goes on the run with her, and then mayhem ensues.
Yes. I understand that there was this long period where you're hoping it's going to go, you're expecting it's going to go.
The longest process for a TV show ever.
Why? What is this?
This never happens. For anyone who's not familiar with how television works, there's a long development process, but once an actors and all, you know, the actors and the directors are on board, it's go time. Basically, you film a pilot, and if the pilot's good and the network likes it, you get it on either the fall or mid-season. Right. And so 2017, we film a pilot for mid-season. This is going to be a mid-season show. We film a pilot, I believe, in June of 2017. Everything is positive about the process. I think the studio and the network were happy about the dailies that were coming in, and I'm thinking, okay, we're going to go into production in September in Atlanta. And it just kept getting pushed. And by November, we were looking at possibly, you know, it was going to go into production in January, February of the next year in 2018. And then I hear that they're going to reshoot the pilot, and which is so unheard of in television.
Yeah.
If you have to reshoot a pilot, there's something really wrong.
And it's expensive.
And so we've reshot parts of the pilot.
Did you have the same child co-star? Because she would have probably...
I know. That's the thing too. We did. We had Sanaya. We can kind of notice her. She's basically a different person.
Because she was, 11 or so?
She was 11, and then she was 12 when we filmed the second one. But we made some changes. We simplified the script a little bit to just focus on Project Noah, which is the secret government facility that has been tasked with trying to find a cure for infectious diseases. So we focused primarily on that because the original script showed the future. It was bookended by the future. The tale basically spans 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And so our first season focuses primarily on the first few months of how these scientists started the end of the world. But yeah, we reshot that second pilot in 2018 and then went into production the summer of 2018. So it was almost a full,
it's crazy,
full year before.
Was there ever any point at that during that period when you're saying to yourself, I like this, I'm optimistic about it, but like I have to move on with my life?
Yeah, I mean, she's not getting any younger,
right.
Sanaya, and I'm not getting any younger. Thankfully, I have a development deal over 20, right. So I was able to continue to create. My projects were going in the right direction, mm-hmm. So I could focus on them. I was able, actually, Fox allowed me to work on a show called Nobodies with some really talented, funny people, and I got to do 12 episodes of that, because generally you're only allowed to do 3 episodes of another show, and so they let me do 12,
wow.
And so I made a little bit of money there and was making money off my development deal, and was sitting tight hoping that this would go, but this was a big gamble on everybody's part. But the whole development process took Matt Reeves and Ridley Scott and everyone involved, I believe, 8 years to get to this point.
Although we have to say, I mean, like, they don't call them vampires on your show, but the whole concept of vampires and genre, it's never been like hotter, right? I mean, there is a great interest in it that probably makes it worth sticking it out for something like that.
Yeah,
right?
Which is one of the reasons I wanted to sign on to begin with. It was a great story that had a lot of heart that was surrounded by this genre. I had never been a part of a genre, and I thought this would be a good opportunity to do that, but also to have that heart that Liz Heldens brings to her projects.
Well, yeah, I mean, for all the blood sucking and other things that may occur, the heart of the show is still this almost parental relationship between you and Sanaya. And, you know, famously, everyone's always been told since W.C. Fields, don't work with children or animals. And yet,
somebody said that I came up with that. And I recently, they're like, so you came up with don't work with children and animals. I said, no, actually, W.C. Fields, it's been around. Take it easy.
Right.
But I do agree with that. Yeah.
Well, generally, it would seem to be true. It's going to complicate matters.
It does.
But she's great and your chemistry is great.
Yeah.
Is that just there or not there? Or were you able to cultivate that in some way?
I think we cultivated it. I had to gain her trust, which we used.
Did she know who you are? Was she intimidated by you?
No, not at all. There's a funny story that she had no idea. We were sitting in a car about to film a very emotional scene, and we had some time, just her and I sitting in the car while they're setting up. And she turns to me and she goes, somebody told me you played a character named Zach Morris. And I said, yeah, I did. And she goes, well, I don't know who that is. She goes, I don't even know who Zach Morris is. She goes, the only Zach I know is Zac Efron. And he's going to be my husband someday. And I thought, oh, okay.
That's great.
I said, great.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I'll introduce you guys. Yeah, you know? Right. That was on the first pilot. So that was in 2017. Right. So when we come back to film the second pilot in 2018, she's like, almost one of the first things she says to me is like, she goes, oh my God, you're Zach Morris.
She was,
she saw the show on Netflix. And then she's just quoting parts of the show. She's trying to put me in timeout. She's timing out. She's walking around set doing that. And I'm like, that doesn't work on me.
That's so funny.
She now understands a little bit
about your background.
About my 30 years in this business.
Do you think that having, for most viewers who do know your track record to this point, your trajectory to this point, people talk about screen personas, which when you've been around for decades doing this, you're going to have played lots of different kinds of parts. But maybe the part that you are most closely associated with makes the audience see you in a certain way when you do something new. There's a reflexive, I like this guy, or I trust this guy, or whatever. Do you feel that exists with you? And does it maybe, you know, like, I think it might, if it does, help in this case, because if we just have some random guy with the child, you know, doing this, we're not going to maybe have that innate belief that this guy's going to be doing the right thing or is a solid guy. The same baggage that might have caused typecasting at the downside of this could actually be to your advantage in the long run, where people just like you.
Possibly. It's happened with this, with The Passage, as well as with Pitch. Pitch and Passage, I changed my appearance. For Pitch, I had a full beard. I gained 25 pounds. I've kept that weight on for The Passage because I felt it helped with the image of a paternal figure to this child. But both times it's happened where people watch the first few episodes and not realize it's actually me that they're watching. And I guess, you know, that sort of dispels your theory. But I also feel that the writing is what, you know, Liz Heldon created this character. Liz Heldens, she always has that S on that thing. But she created this character. It's on the page. Yeah. I always say to her, she'll come back to me and say, that was a beautiful scene between you and Sanaya. I love that scene. I go, Liz, you wrote that. We're just saying the words. I mean, that's all on the page, and it's just there. But yeah, maybe people are watching it, but a lot of people don't recognize me, and they still appreciate
it. Well, and it's not to take anything away from the performance, which is still, you know, just as great as if you were somebody nobody had ever seen. I'm not saying it's any lesser. It's interesting when people
I do the same thing though, but yeah. I'll watch a movie, and if I like the person, I like their character even more.
Right.
So I think that, yeah, that definitely happens.
Where does the show go from here at this point? You're waiting to hear the official.
I'm at that point again where I'm 10 episodes and we'll see where it goes. We're just waiting for the second season. I think everything is positive. Yeah. We've got some really good numbers.
Yeah.
I'm so proud of the final product. I'm really enjoying watching the show as a casual viewer.
And it's impressive. You're doing movie, there's movie level.
It's amazing.
VFX.
Yeah.
You did a 2-hour finale that must have, you had to, I'm sure it was a grind to, I read that you guys had only like 8 days to do that 2-hour finale, I think.
No. The 2-hour finale was 9 and 10. Fox decided to run those together consecutively to make a 2-hour finale. So we filmed 9 and we filmed 10. Each episode takes 8 days to film.
Got it.
But 9, there's a sequence in there where the virals break out, and on a film, you would take a month to shoot that sequence, and we shot it in a day and a half. Some of the most ambitious storytelling I've ever been a part of.
Yeah.
I mean, pitch was pretty ambitious. This blew it away.
Excellent. Well, if we can wind down with just kind of a fun thing, just like first thing that comes to your mind.
Okay.
When you're flipping through TV channels and happen upon Saved by the Bell, what do you do?
Watch for a few moments and then change the channel.
Yeah.
I have a hard time watching myself. I'm better at it now because I feel like so much time has passed. So I may watch the rest of it just because I don't remember any of it. And so watching it is...
You don't remember the making of any of it?
I don't remember. No, I remember moments. Like a few, like I can remember that moment, my first time mm-hmm. breaking the fourth
right,
wall.
Right.
There's a few moments of like personal things that happen mm-hmm. on stage, but filming, I don't remember.
Is that just because in the moment it didn't have that grand significance to you?
No,
just
we weren't sentimental. I mean, you're 15, 16, right. Nothing's right. really, you know, you're right. sentimental about anything. Same with NYPD Blue. I was watching, I was traveling back from Atlanta, and my seatmate sitting next to me, he claims, and this was after the flight, but he was watching 4 episodes of NYPD Blue. Next to me on his iPad.
And you didn't even...
And after we land, and that's when people start conversations, because, you're only going to be around the person for another 5 minutes.
Right.
I said, what are you doing? He's a producer. He's a producer of some film that was filming in Atlanta. And he's like, what do you do? And I said, you were watching me for the last 4 hours. He goes, oh, my God. He's like, I'm so sorry. He goes, I would never do that. I wasn't intentionally watching the show, knowing that you were there. He's like, but that's just my thing. He goes, I watch these episodes over and over. And I said, well, I'm kind of glad you did, because I was actually enjoying the show, because I was watching it going, look at that young guy.
Right.
But yeah, I don't remember much about NYPD Blue either.
Interesting.
Yeah.
This windup is, I know I'm talking rapid fire, but this one needs a little bit of a windup. Nostalgia for the 80s and 90s is rampant these days. We've seen reunions and reboots of everything from Roseanne to The Karate Kid. Several of you guys from Saved by the Bell did The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon a few years ago. It nearly broke the internet. I think 39 million views on YouTube. Then they've started this Saved by the Bell pop-up restaurant, went from Chicago to West Hollywood, and that became a phenomenon, even I think an off-Broadway show. The point is, to what do you attribute the enduring popularity of that particular show?
That's the question, isn't it? I have no idea. I'm okay. I mean, me personally, I'm okay with never seeing a reboot ever again. I like original content.
Yeah.
I really appreciate what Cobra Kai has done. I appreciate what Roseanne's done, what Fuller House has done. It's great. 90210 now is heard for Fox. But I'm okay with never seeing a reboot ever again. I don't have this drive to want to see shows that I was a huge fan of A-Team. I was a huge fan of Magnum P.I. I don't need to see these reboots, me personally. So I don't know what the desire is to have these reboots.
Are there any circumstances where they could rope you into doing one?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they if it was a good product that I felt wouldn't tarnish the original product, then yeah, I'm open to hearing anything.
And would there be a way that it could be the entire cast? I know people have talked about fact, Dustin.
Listen, I've worked with I've worked with actors that I couldn't stand being in the room with. Dustin is not one of those people. So
I guess it seemed to have stemmed from the book, right?
Oh, who cares about the book? The book was fiction. Right. I mean, it was his. I don't know what it was.
He was going through something, but
I don't know what it was, and it was.
But just because I know people were surprised, I forget if it was on Andy Cohen or something recently when they heard it had been 25 years since you guys had spoken.
But that's normal. When was the last time I spoke to another castmate on another project? Okay, you know, I did. Last time I spoke to Jacinda Barrett when I did a show called DC or Gabriel Olds. Actors, we just don't talk to, you know, it's not something that.
If you walked in here right now, you guys would be okay. You'd be okay.
Hey, what's going on, man?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, would we go grab a beer afterwards? Probably not.
Right. But that doesn't mean anything.
I don't even care about it. Honestly, there's nothing, like, I don't take any of that stuff personally, especially when it comes to work.
Right.
When it comes to work, you shut all that stuff off.
Where would Zach Morris be today?
I don't know. I liked what I did originally. What I had done on Fallon in 2009, I was promoting Raising the Bar, and I went on Fallon's show as Zach Morris, and I explained to him why my name was Mark Paul Gosselaar because SAG made me change it and all this stuff. I created that dialogue with one of his writers. It was an 11-page dialogue, and I really had a great time doing something like that. I would love to do Fallon's show again. I think there's, you know, the 30th anniversary is coming up. And if we could do something with Fallon again, that'd be great.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think I said this, but I love what they've done on Cobra Kai.
Yeah.
Cool. That type of reboot, I'd be really interested in exploring.
This is the Karate Kid.
Yeah.
Last two are a little heavier. This week, we unexpectedly lost a sort of relative contemporary of yours, 7 years older. Like you, the coolest guy on a 90s show about high school, only in his case, it was Beverly Hills 90210. That's Luke Perry. The outpouring of tributes and love and affection for him has been really nice to see, but a lot of people have said it would have been kind of nice if this had happened when he was around to experience it. I think there's sometimes people are in some ways taken for granted or whatever when they're around. So I guess the question is, did you know him, and what has it been like for you to process? It's an unusual and very weird thing to have somebody quite young have this, you know, everybody's still in a little shock, I think.
Yeah, I knew Luke. We actually worked together on John from Cincinnati for David Milch. And we had a scene. I really don't remember that scene, but I just saw a picture of us working together. Growing up sort of in the industry, him being on 90210 and Saved by the Bell at the same time, we were filming at the same time. There's a lot of crossovers. I always had a great interaction with him. But more than that, I don't have any stories or anecdotes.
No,
to hear about a guy 52 years old, children, you know, fiance, and everything that was sort of left behind. I mean, it's
terrible.
It's terrible. I'm 45 now, and to think, my God, he was only 7 years older than me, and he went through this. It's just it was shocking. I feel terrible for the people in his life.
Yeah. Last question: what in, you know, it's now what 34, 35 years in this business? What are you proudest of, and where do you think you would be today if, let's say, just since the probably, you know, the first major break in a way would be Saved by the Bell, if that had not happened 30 plus years later, where would you be today?
If Saved by the Bell hadn't happened, I still think I would have been in this business. I don't know to what capacity or in what direction, but I would have been in this business. There was a lot of my peers at that time that are still in this business that are doing well. I still feel like a rookie. I really do. I look at my career. I look at my resume. If I'll, you know, happen to glance at an IMDb thing and go down that rabbit hole, and I look at it and I go, I have so much more to accomplish. I have so much more that I want to do. I haven't done everything that I want to do. I'm still learning. I'm still open to it. I still enjoy the process. It hasn't broken me yet. There's been many, many times it's been very close calls. Possibly if passage doesn't go, you know, we could have a different conversation. No, I'll be fine. But yeah, I'm still enjoying the process. I've always felt this way, is that the business doesn't define me, but I like being a part of it. I like doing my work, coming in, creating, working with some great people, and then going back to my life as a family man, a husband, a father. Yeah, but I there's still so much left that I feel I have yet to accomplish.
It's really been a treat to follow the first 30 plus years, and I look forward to the next
one.
When
I look back, 30 years is a long time, but I still feel fresh. Still feel like I'd be put in.
It's, you know, you do
sitting on the
job.
Bench and ready to go in.
Well, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.